temple includes this appeal: to report any spiritual or physical favors granted through prayer in Father Tolton's name, please write to... Dr. Liuni is one of those on the receiving end of such reports, and when the evidence seems credible and the funding is solidly in place, he dispatches Euclide Abasha. Though Abasha is reluctant to admit it, that funding component is the reason he spends so much time in the United States. So much time, in fact, that it made sense for him to lease his Logan Circle apartment in 2010. The United States has produced only 11 saints in its history, and just two of them native-born. Yet it currently fields an abundance of proposed saints in various phases of progress with actively financed causes, 54 of them. Why? One might argue that with the country's vast Catholic population, 70 million at last count, the presence of more than 11 saints bears a certain mathematical logic, a nod to John Edensor Littlewood's theory of large numbers. One could also argue, however, and Father Ace, whose native Nigeria has yet to see a saint canonized, does indeed make this argument, that the United States' wealth, not its Catholic population, not its miracle-spangled history, not its spiritual timbre, is the real fuel for these campaigns.
"When a miracle happens in rural Nigeria, who hears about it?" he asks. "Who pays to have it documented? Who gets on an airplane and brings the case to Rome? These things, they cost money."
It's important to note that hiring an advocate like Dr. Liuni, as with hiring any lawyer, is no guarantee of success. Some of Dr. Liuni's causes, including well-financed American causes, have been languishing for more than 40 years. Supporters of Archbishop Nicholas Fahey's cause for sainthood, one supporter in particular, wire-transferred the funds that brought Euclide Abasha to Mississippi. Fahey was beatified by Pope Benedict XVI in 2006, beatification being the penultimate step on canonization's long stairwell, after the Vatican awarded him credit for the spontaneous restoration of vision in an Indiana boy who'd gone blind from macular degeneration. That left Fahey one miracle shy of sainthood. Fahey's cause has been in Dr. Liuni's hands for more than 20 years, which is not unusual, but unlike most other causes, it has a principal backer, a 69-year-old Detroit trucking magnate named Norton Skagg. According to the foreword he wrote for a booklet promoting Fahey's cause, Skagg was a reckless and self-absorbed 27-year-old when in 1974, Reverend Fahey came crashing into his life. At the time, Skagg was married and working for his father, who started Freight Connections Trucking with a single used panel truck. But Skagg had an ungovernable wild streak that often brought him, as in this case, to the brink of self-destruction. Following what Skagg has obliquely called a night of sin in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, he found himself driving through the dark in a remotely wooded area where he was able to tune just a single station on his car's radio, an AM station broadcasting one of Reverend Fahey's sermons. For more than an hour, Skagg found himself captivated by Fahey's voice and message. Then Skagg's car brushed a guardrail and flipped and kept flipping. Skagg, who was unbelted, seemed to float around the car's interior, he wrote, like an astronaut in zero gravity, before losing consciousness. What woke him was the sound of state troopers assessing the wreckage with what sounded like black laughter. The car was so gruesomely mangled as to be comical, a riddle of twisted steel. Yet the radio was still playing, Reverend Fahey's voice a bit softer and fringed with static, and Norton Skagg, while bruised and bloodied, climbed from the car himself. "The Reverend Fahey's voice and me were the only two things that survived that crash," Skagg wrote, "and that served to join us forever after." What walked away from the wreckage, he continued, was a new man. That new man built his father's company, now called Freight Connects, into the fifth largest trucking company in the United States, with annual revenue of more than $10 billion. All credit for the success, and more importantly for the Augustinian turnaround Skagg made in his personal and spiritual life, Skagg attributes to the guidance and guardianship of Reverend Fahey. For anyone who's ever found himself or herself on the interstate behind a Freight Connects truck, wondering about the quotation painted onto the rear of every trailer. Faith is to living as headlights are to driving. That's a line of Fahey's. Skaggs struck up a correspondence with Fahey, and after Fahey's death in 1980, Skaggs petitioned the church to open an official cause for sainthood, seeded the money for the Archbishop Nicholas Fahey Foundation, and eventually retained the services of Dr. Leone. Dealing with Norton Skaggs isn't like dealing with the guilds of nuns and monsignors to which Dr. Leone has long been accustomed. It's more like manning the crow's nest for Captain Ahab. Skaggs is hard-nosed, implacable, indifferent to the ancient delicacies of Vatican protocol, and most of all, impatient. He badly wants to see Fahey canonized before he dies, to fully liquidate the debt he feels he owes. Hence Skaggs' middle-of-the-night phone call to Rome, after he'd come across a news report about Cameron's recovery and its possible connection to Fahey. Dr. Leone drowsily advised him to let the process advance at the diocesan level. As he's been telling Skaggs for 2 decades, these things take time. Beati from the 9th century are still short a second miracle. But Skaggs was characteristically insistent, especially after Dr. Leone let slip that Euclide was in Tennessee. He offered to put on immediate standby a Freight Connects truck for conveying the investigator to Mississippi. Imagining Euclide, whose passion for a 72 Maserati Spider is opera-worthy, being sentenced to the passenger seat of a long-haul truck, brought a pained smile to Dr. Leone's face. "This won't be necessary," he told Skaggs. Euclide Abasha's first visit in Mississippi, after Father Ace, was to Dot Bearden. Bearden was the one who, less than a week after Cameron's injury, issued a request for prayers for him on Facebook. Aside from doctors, the requester of the alleged miracle is the most significant figure in Euclide Abasha's investigations, more important when they diverge than the actual recipients of the miracle, called miracolati. The miracle, after all, is a form of communication between the saint or saint-in-waiting and the requester. Sometimes the requester and the miracolati are one and the same, but just as often they aren't. The physical favor may be directed at someone else, in this case Cameron. But the spiritual favor, the answered prayer, is bequeathed to the requester. Bearden was out on her front porch when Euclide pulled in. She leapt out of her rocker to gawk at the exotic car in her driveway, her head popping over the railing like a prairie dog's, and devoted the first 20 minutes of the interview to telling Euclide about the classic Ford Mustangs her late husband used to restore. Bearden, who is 82, exemplifies what people mean when describing an elderly person as spry. She exudes honeybee's industriousness, able to tend to the 3 great-grandchildren often in her care, while constantly baking layer cakes and casseroles for the funeral luncheon ministry at St. Michael's Catholic Church, while also attending Mass 4 times a week, and once a week getting her hair coiffed to maintain her aqua-netted white swoop. She is that rare elderly person on whom exercise clothes look truly functional. "Yes," she told Euclide. "Of course she remembered the prayer." She pulled it up for him on the Microsoft tablet her daughter had given her the Christmas before. Dorothy Alice Bearden. "Dear friends, I just heard that Biloxi High School graduate Cameron Harris has been very seriously injured while serving our nation over in Afghanistan. He needs our prayers. Please join me in praying to the Archbishop Nicholas Fahey for his full recovery and return home. Relying upon his merits and power before the Sacred Heart of Jesus, we pray. Yours in Christ, Dot." That she'd issued this prayer on social media was a novelty to Euclide, but one he welcomed. Normally he relies on requesters' recollections of praying, when, how, and to whom, and must ultimately gauge that what they said they did, while kneeling silently in a pew or alone in their bedrooms, is what in fact they did. But here was the ne plus ultra of forensic evidence, a documented, time-stamped prayer, as perfectly preserved on the Internet as a DNA sample sealed in a jar. Below Bearden's post were 13 replies, 3 of them expressing shock and dismay, but 10 indicating that a prayer chain did go into effect that spring. In subsequent questioning, Bearden told Euclide her Friday morning prayer group at St. Michael had maintained their prayers for Cameron's recovery until someone heard he was back in Biloxi, and sadly, unable to walk ever again. Gently, Euclide pressed her.
But you didn't pray after that? After you knew he'd been paralyzed?
Oh, we knew he'd got paralyzed early on. Megan, her granddaughter, heard it from his sister. Once we all heard he was home and was safe, well, I reckon he fell off our prayer list. But I kept praying for him.
You did?
Yes, sir, I did.
By yourself?
That's right.
Did you ever pray a novena?
Sometimes. But mostly it was just like talking.
You and Reverend Fahey?
That's right, just talking, me and him. I'd tell him who was hurting, who could use his grace.
And you'd mention Cameron Harris?
Lots of times, yes, sir, I would. That boy had a hard row, losing his mama the way he did, then him getting blowed up in Afghanistan. You pray for those in need.
But you also prayed for others in need?
Everyone in need, everyone I thought needed grace.
Was Cameron Harris special?
I reckon he needed more grace than just about anybody else.
Later, per protocol, Euclide quizzed Bearden on why she directed her prayers to Fahey and not to another Beati or saint, such as Mother Teresa.
Well, I don't know Mother Teresa. When you read about a saint in a book or something, you don't really know them. How they talk, what their voice sounds like, what it feels like to sit in a room with them. Seeing Reverend Fahey on the TV all them years, I knew him. I knew how to talk to him. I knew what he'd say to me. I knew what he'd do for me.
Now, for Euclide, came the delicate part, determining why the late Nicholas Fahey, swamped by prayers from millions, from priests imploring him to aid the sick among their flocks, to the parents of dying children kneeling despondent at their children's bedsides, why Nicholas Fahey might have plucked from this supplicatory profusion a single appeal among many from Dorothy Alice Bearden of Biloxi, Mississippi. For 2.5 hours he drew from her the story of her life, her 61-year marriage, her children and grandchildren, the peaks and valleys of her 82 years on earth. After a while he zeroed in on her faith, her moral triumphs and failings, the questions and regrets that still wrested her from sleep. Euclide Abasha is often mistaken for a priest. It's a misapprehension he usually dispels, but other times lets slide to his advantage. Priests are confessors, and confessions, as any detective knows, supply the protein to an investigation. Yet nothing Bearden revealed gave him pause to doubt either her, or for that matter, Reverend Fahey's potential receptiveness. Still, the interrogation was intense. At the end of it, Dot Bearden, whom no one has ever seen tire, who is known around St. Michael as the Energizer Bunny, whose great-grandchildren drop from weariness before she does, Dot Bearden collapsed. The sheer magnitude of what was under review, her splayed-open life and beliefs, the grand forces she appeared to have set into action, paled her face and sagged her eyes, and when she tried to speak, no sound emerged from her dry lips. Euclide removed her shoes for her, as she was eventually able to request, and fetched her a quilt so that she could nap on the couch. She asked him to pray with her, and he did. As Euclide made to leave, she stopped him with a question.
Was it really me?
Her voice warbled. In the span of 4 hours, it seemed the 82 years she'd so valiantly outraced had somehow caught up with her.
Was it really me that done this?
Of course not, Euclide smiled. It was God. Euclide Abasha's next visit, the following morning, was to Dr. Janice Lorimar Cuevas. Hers was a tough interview to wrangle. As usual with physicians, he identified himself over the phone as Dr. Abasha, employing the honorific that Italians bestow upon any college graduate. As Dr. Leone had taught him, identifying oneself as a lawyer, even a canon lawyer, is the quickest way to spook an American physician into silence. Janice sighed. She was frankly tired of discussing Cameron's case, she told him. And when he explained his connection to the church, she noted that she'd met with Father Ace not once, but twice, and couldn't think of anything to add. Euclide is used to this, and much worse with doctors, some of whom refuse to speak with him at all. Many of them are defensive, he explains. They view their inability to explain a medical situation as a professional failing.
as something they don't wish to have scrutinized. Others don't want to lend credence, even by discussing the case, to any non-secular interpretation. Janice felt traces of both reactions, she says, yet despite her protestations, Cameron's case was still entangling her mind as kudzu entangles an oak. When Oakley they called, in fact, Cameron's medical file happened to be staring up at her from her laptop screen. She said he could have an hour. Janice was surprised then at how quickly she found herself warming to Euclide. He was exponentially more fluent in medicine than Father Ace, or really anyone without a medical degree with whom she'd discussed Cameron's case, plus some people with medical degrees, but also, she admits, impossibly charming. It was like having Marcello Mastroianni sitting in your office, she says, with an embarrassed flutter of a laugh. Not for nothing did the Italian press deem the young Euclide a batticuore, or heartthrob. Spending time with Euclide Abascia in public, one cannot fail to notice the effect he has on women, nor, for that matter, the effect they have upon him. As Dr. Leone is known to say, were it not for Euclide's fondness for fast cars and beautiful women, he'd make a sensational priest, or husband. Bewitching charms aside, however, Euclide impressed Janice with his line of questioning. Unlike Father Ace, who seemed to be campaigning for Cameron's recovery to be inexplicable, for Janice to throw up her arms in terminal bewilderment, Euclide seemed determined to ferret out a medical explanation. Several of his questions prompted her to scribble notes for her own follow-up. After a while, mildly dazzled, she told him he obviously had experience with cases like Cameron's. "A little, yes," he replied. "But with recovery from paralysis, there's almost always a natural explanation. In fact, if you're asking about my own experience, I should retract the word almost and just say always. You have to go back a long way, to 1977, for the most recent case of paralysis recovery that the congregation approved as a miracle." This was the first time he'd deployed the word miracle, and Janice felt herself rankling. His incisive questioning had eclipsed the fact that he was there on behalf of the church, equipped with a very different agenda than hers. "So you're... what?" she asked him. "A doctor of supernatural medicine?" "I would call myself an investigator of thaumaturgic events." She frowned. "Thaumaturgic? This is the scientific term for miraculous." She snorted lightly. "There's a lot of irony baked into that definition." "Perhaps." Euclide shrugged, smiling. "But then, as Soren Kierkegaard said, just because something inconceivable happens in the scope of our perceptions doesn't mean it didn't happen." "Well, you should know that I am no believer in miracles," she told him. "I wasn't before, and I'm not one now." Euclide, used to hearing statements like this from physicians, gave her his canned response. "Your beliefs, doctor, like mine, are irrelevant to this investigation. Only your findings." "Okay, but you'll use my findings to draw a conclusion," she said. "Isn't that the dividing line here? Isn't that where our purposes diverge? I've been hunting for a medical explanation, and you're hunting for a miracle." "My objective," he countered, as warm as she was cool, "is precisely the same as yours has been, to determine the precise cause of this recovery."
"Ah, but you have another cause in your pocket."
"I'm sorry?"
"If my findings are inconclusive, that's it, they're inconclusive. But to you, that means they are conclusive of a miracle."
"Not so," he said. "If you have no medical conclusions, and I have no conclusions to offer, then there's a void, and we agree on it. We are in harmony. And this harmony is what I report. The Consulta Medica examines our findings very rigorously. After that, it's up to the congregation to determine if there might be a spiritual conclusion."
"But that's what I'm talking about," she said. "In the absence of an explanation, the explanation is God. I'm sorry, but I find that, I hope I'm not offending you, but I find that reductive, to say the least."
"Offending me?" Euclide flashed her a big, almost mischievous grin. "Discussions like this, they're my candy. But you're voicing a common misperception about miracles. You see, the absences of medical intervention or a natural explanation do not in themselves signify divine intervention.
It isn't the absence of anything that proves a miracle. Just the opposite. It's the presence of the divine.
Which isn't provable, she said flatly.
But that's what joins us here together today, isn't it? Again came Euclides' smile, slightly flirtatious and wholly self-assured. We are both confronted with things we cannot prove. We are both of us out past the borders of observation and data, and into the realm of belief.
Janice leaned back in her chair and considered this, though not for long.
Euclides' swart charms and breezy intelligence were brushing a glossy sheen onto the conversation. But underneath that lacquer, she thought, was the same circular reasoning. God exists because the Bible says he does, and the Bible is God's word, etc. She'd been hearing from religious types all her life, especially as a girl in the Mississippi Delta, where her lack of a church affiliation, she didn't dare admit atheism until college, marked her for freakdom, made her a bullseye for conversion. Perhaps, she'd later think, it was this low-grade irritation, triggering an impulse to rebut the absurdly paranormal mindset of Euclides, and by extension, all those grade-school missionaries who'd invited her to fellowship with them, with a different variety of outrageous thinking, that led her to divulge to this total stranger an idea that had been fermenting inside her for weeks, ever since her lunch with Cameron, and that she'd shared with no one save her husband, Nap. She tapped her desk with a pencil and ran her tongue along the inside of her teeth, an anxious habit. Then she said, I've answered your questions. Can I ask you one?
By all means,
Euclides answered. Have you ever been involved in a case in which someone faked a miracle?
Faked?
Faked, as in a hoax.
Euclides leveled a darkly curious gaze at her, and when he spoke, he picked his words with slow caution, as in the way one navigates a room suddenly blackened by a power outage. I've investigated dozens of alleged miracles that turned out to have been the result of natural forces.
That's not what I'm talking about, she said. I'm talking about, I guess the word would be fraudulent, so-called miracles that turned out to have been deceptions.
I see, he said.
He was staring at her now, and she thought she could see the color of his eyes drop a shade, from bright blue to indigo, as if a cloud were passing through his head. I've only heard or read of such cases, which do exist. By the time a case reaches my attention, though, it's already undergone a preliminary investigation at the diocese. His voice went trailing off, squelched by this new element Janice had slipped into the room.
Do you have reason to believe, he finally asked, that we might be looking at such a case?
Janice blew the air from her cheeks, finding her own voice squelched by that same atmospheric shift. Then, with sluggish care of her own, she said, Let's just say I'm more comfortable with a human explanation for this recovery than with no explanation, and definitely more than with any mystical explanation.
Euclides tilted forward in his chair, close enough for Janice for her to catch a slim breeze of cologne floating her way.
So you've thought about this, he said to her.
She almost laughed.
I've thought about everything.
Can you tell me how it would be possible?
Well, it's all theoretical.
Theoretically, then.
She tapped her pencil again, and then, after a what-the-hell exhalation, she laid it out.
Some patients, as I guess you know, can make full recoveries from spinal cord injuries, even when they seem to be paralyzed at the time of trauma.
You're talking about spinal shock, he said.
I am. Functionality is recovered as the cord swelling goes down, usually within 6 months. Or in this case, possibly, after a successful decompression fusion.
Euclides nodded for her to continue.
But what if the patient, Janice said, had a reason to want to be paralyzed?
A bloated pause.
Because not being paralyzed, might he meant have to return to combat?
Euclides' eyebrows performed a quick dance of intrigue before burrowing into a frown.
But how can one fake paralysis?
It's not easy, but not impossible either, she said. I found several cases in the VA files, online too.
Among those, she explained, was a 2012 case in which an Army specialist,
supposedly paralyzed from the belly button down after suffering a traumatic brain injury in Iraq, received a mortgage-free, wheelchair-adapted house in Texas from a national nonprofit called Shelter for Our Troops. A neighbor boy flying his new drone caught video of the man standing at his backyard grill flipping burgers. In this case, though, I think the patient... Janice couldn't bear the accusatory voltage referring to Cameron by name, would have required guidance at Brook Army Medical Center, an accomplice on the hospital staff. Euclide asked her the same question she'd asked herself. Who would do this, and why? The answer Janice gave him was based upon a theory her husband had devised while away at a legal convention in Mobile, which he'd sketched for her in a rambling late-night email. Someone at Brook, a physician like you, a nurse, I don't know, who'd seen too many boys come home in jagged pieces, who didn't see the point of these drawn-out wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, who'd come to hate the idea of gluing these guys back together just to ship them back to the front lines, who then came upon a patient so traumatized by what he'd seen, done, experienced, and so terrified of going back that he was willing to do anything, even to voluntarily immobilize himself to avoid going back, someone who couldn't bear to see the fear and dread in the patient's eyes, couldn't decline a plea for help. That's who. That's my best and really only explanation for the imaging, she said. To solidify the diagnosis, she explained, this theoretical accomplice would have needed to swap a more severe MRI into Cameron's file, and perhaps to fudge the results of Cameron's tests, or to coach him on squeaking through them on his own. He or she would have then seen Cameron discharged and sent home to Biloxi, with a medical retirement and full disability, and straight into the arms of a sister whose devotion to him was demonstrably limitless, and whose domineering manner during Janice's medical consults might have been, in narrow-eyed retrospect, a way of shielding her brother from suspicion, of shifting attention from him to her. Euclide digested all this for a while, with his lips pursed and his pen poised in his raised hand as though to scribble notes in the air. But then, he said, we come to the event of August 23rd. The recovery, right, Janice said, before a sudden spastic gulp. A gurgle of something acidic caught in her throat, something that felt like self-loathing. This wasn't what Cameron Harris had authorized when he'd given her permission to discuss his case with church officials. But she was in too deep now, connecting the dots too smoothly and rapidly to stop herself. So it's been 4 years, she said. The patient's terror has subsided. The war is winding down, and there's no chance he'll ever be sent back into action. And he's tired of the subterfuge, the sores, maybe the loneliness. He wants to be free to be himself again, to walk again, to live the life he compromised in order to avoid returning to his unit. Perhaps he fell in love, Euclide offered. Who knows? We could list 10,000 reasons why he'd want his mobility back. Maybe his sister got tired of it, too, having to drive him around everywhere, do all the shopping, I don't know. Yes, okay, but what about his legs? We just went over this a little while ago. They were very clearly atrophied. That, she said, a flourish of certainty in her voice, is the single biggest piece of evidence here. Euclide scrunched his face and shook his head. I would think the muscular degradation actually negates this theory. No, look, she cut in. His legs were atrophied, but not so much that he wasn't able to stand on August 23rd. The fact that he stood up and somehow walked, that's been one of the biggest riddles of this whole thing. If you spend 4 years in a wheelchair, whether from actual paralysis or pretend paralysis, your leg muscles are going to atrophy. They're going to waste away. Deterioration begins after just 2 weeks of immobility. On top of that, you've got deterioration of the trunk muscles, which would make balancing almost impossible. Loss of length and trunk muscle, lack of coordination, loss of sensation, and proprioception, the sense of where one's joints are in space. All of this is what makes his ambulation so unbelievable. Right, she said. But let's say you're up and walking just a little bit every day. Maybe to the bathroom and back, maybe to the kitchen when the window blinds are down, whatever. In that case, you might retain just enough muscular functionality and coordination to be able to pull off the appearance of a spontaneous recovery. To get up out of your wheelchair in a convenience store parking lot and take a few steps in front of witnesses who spent years seeing you paralyzed. To do the whole hallelujah pony show. to enact a miracle, Euclide said quietly.
That's right, said Janice, falling back into her chair. A goddamn miracle.
Chapter 14. Barely a heartbeat after Euclide left her office, Dr. Janice Lorimar Cuevas felt such a physical onslaught of remorse and horror that, jackknifing herself sideways, she retched into her wastebasket. What evidence did she have to accuse or almost accuse Cameron the way she just had? None. She hadn't even called Brook Army Medical Center to speak to the staffers who treated Cameron, to see if she might catch a funky whiff. And was it even possible to hack the VA's VISTA system? She didn't know. Yes, she'd diagnosed Cameron with PTSD, lending minor credence to her premise for a motive. But she'd diagnosed hundreds of combat veterans with PTSD and couldn't remember Cameron saying a single extraordinary thing about combat. Certainly nothing to indicate he might go to such spectacular lengths to avoid it. It had been one thing for her and Knapp to hash out their black-hearted theories in the evenings, as Knapp stirred Sazerac and Janice exercised whatever story-making muscles she'd inherited from her father. But for her to have leaked it to the entrancing investigator from Rome, to have unleashed her suspicions and sent them scurrying out into the world. Janice was revolted with herself. She recalled something Knapp had said one night when they were cooking up the theory. If it's true, you know, you'll look like a fool for having fallen for his con. If it's not true, though, you'll feel like a fool for thinking it. Also a big asshole. What had opened the spigot for it with Euclide, she decided, was him uttering that empty little sack of a word. Miracle. The whole exchange after that had turned into a kind of proxified argument between her and Euclide and between reason and faith, and in order to win that argument, to trump his magical thinking with a perhaps equally outlandish theory, but at least one grounded in reality, she'd pushed Cameron Harris into the pyre. She'd sacrificed him to make a point, had given him up as a burnt offering, just like they did in the damn Bible. Or had she? Because what if it was true? Knowing Cameron the way she did, even the veneer-toothed, flashbulb-attracting version of him she'd encountered at lunch a month earlier, it felt beyond difficult to believe. But what was easier to believe? That a dead televangelist convinced his heavenly landlord to reach down from the clouds and, breaking all natural laws, hoist a paralyzed man to his feet? She wouldn't have divulged her suspicions to Euclide if some part of her didn't believe them. Right? It wasn't as though she'd enjoyed constructing this ugly theory, with all its kamikaze implications for her career aside, perhaps, from a few aha Nancy Drew exultations that probably had more to do with the presence of Knapp and his killer Sazerac, and to the fact that the two career junkies were actually doing something together. She wasn't like her father. She didn't revel in fabulism. She didn't make up stories for the hell of it. She didn't make up stories at all. So what did she believe? Not think. Believe. She laid her palms on her desk as though trying to ward off seasickness. Euclide was right about one thing. She had exhausted the limits of seeing. She'd passed, just like he'd said, into an entirely different realm now. And suddenly this question, what do I believe, felt like the most fundamental and essential question she'd ever asked herself. For all of her 33 years, Janice realized, she'd been defining herself by what she didn't believe. Not in Santa Claus or in God, same difference, she might have said. Not in reckless love or in mind-altering substances, the occasional Knapp Cuevas cocktail accepted. Not in market-driven health care, or in running barefoot to prevent injury, or in Bikram yoga being more effective than regular yoga, not in idleness or indiscipline or the luxurious lethargy of introspection, not in metaphors or symbolic language, not in the little green gremlins her father claimed had sucked the life out of her mother through cocktail straws, not in stories of any kind. But years of inventorying what she didn't believe had been a way of eluding the question now holding her fast to her desk, making her late for a patient consult, making her own legs feel suddenly and ironically useless, with a vomit-spattered wastebasket beside her feet. What did she believe? Not just about Cameron Harris. Though yes, of course, about Cameron Harris. Was he a fraud or a saint? And did that make her a fool or an asshole? But about all the facets of existence that can't be glimpsed or measured, no matter how hard you stare or try. She was feeling a strange and unfamiliar pain somewhere in her body that she couldn't quite locate, a place she knew that Euclide Abasha and all those like him would smugly identify as her soul. Euclide, for his part, didn't quite believe Janice's theory about Cameron. A leap of faith, he says, is required to believe in God. But to believe a conspiracy theory, one has to leap considerably farther. His sense was that Janice was groping, half-blindly, for a tactile resolution to this mystery. Her frustration had been apparent to him even as she'd charted the broad strokes of the case. Still, he couldn't dismiss it. Years as a prosecutor had inured him to the vast turpitude of human behaviors, equipping him with a capacity to believe almost anything about the berserk ways people act under duress. And while it seemed a stretch to think that out of cowardice a man would willingly paralyze himself for 4 years, well, he'd witnessed worse stretching from people, in much worse directions. Like all conspiracy theories, he thought, Janice's carried a little bit of sense, masquerading as a lot. But that little bit of sense was enough to color his subsequent interviews, with Leyte Hatt especially, whom he found behind the counter at the Busy Bee the next morning. In most of Euclide's cases, the nature and character of the Miracolati are peripheral or even immaterial to the investigation. The exception to this is when the requester of the miracle and its recipient are the same person. When a cancer sufferer, for instance, appeals to a saint for his or her own healing. No attention is paid to the dicey question of whether or not a recipient might have deserved or even wanted the granted miracle, a deliberate oversight informally known as the Dismas rule, in reference to the thief who was crucified beside Jesus, whom Jesus is said to have dispatched directly to heaven despite his moral slackness. In one of Euclide's early cases, in fact, the Miracolati, a young Irish woman, who somehow made a full recovery after 21 minutes underwater put her in a brain-damaged coma, refused to cooperate with his inquiry, possibly, rumor had it, because her near drowning had been a suicide attempt. The congregation approved the miracle anyway. Hatt couldn't have gathered this from Euclide's line of questioning, however. After eliciting her account of what she'd witnessed outside the store on that August afternoon, he began probing her about Cameron. Does Cameron Harris strike you as a trustworthy person?
What do you mean?
Well, let's see. Would you extend him credit?
Oh, we never do that. No way. Not for anyone.
What do you know about him?
What does a shopkeeper know? He likes beer. He used to smoke generics, but now I think he smokes Marlboros.
That's all you know?
I know the things that I've read in the newspapers.
But what did you know about him before you read the newspapers, besides the beer and all that?
I knew he got hurt in the war. I didn't know where or how. His sister took care of him. I knew that. She did all the talking. He never said much.
Anything else?
My husband said he heard he got arrested once.
Arrested for what?
He didn't hear that part.
But Hatt seemed unnerved by Euclide's questions. As the interview went on, her postern hands seemed increasingly positioned to protect her abdomen, something the young Euclide had learned to associate with agitation and deception— only served to create a kind of feedback loop. The more anxious Hatt seemed when discussing Cameron, the deeper Euclide tried to dig, thereby compounding her anxiety. Hatt, for her part, says she was nervous, for two reasons. One, because this lawyerly man in her store reminded Hatt of all the state and federal tax officials who'd ambushed her and Quinn over the years, sweeping into the Busy Bee with catastrophic audits and collections— no one carrying a briefcase into the Busy Bee ever pulled anything happy from it. More significantly, however, Euclide's question suggested to her that he had doubts, big official doubts, about Cameron's recovery, that perhaps something false or rotten was festering beneath the miracle sheen. Pockmarking her mind as she fielded Euclide's questions were thoughts of poor Gil, and the last-ditch hopes he'd pinned on the busy bee. Of all the people who were daily coming from near and far to plant themselves in that 8-by-12-foot rectangle painted in the parking lot, praying closed-eyed and open-armed for that blessed lightning to strike twice. Peering past Euclide, as he was asking her if she'd ever heard rumors about Cameron walking before his recovery, no. If she'd ever seen his feet jerk or move, no. If she'd ever happened to notice the condition of his shoe soles. His shoe soles? Hat saw behind him the canyons of miracle merchandise that had reversed her and Quinn's and little Kim's fortunes, that were making the coming Christmas unlike any they'd ever had before, that had been for the Lays what rain is to a drought-cursed farmer. But then she also remembered the dark prickle she'd felt watching Cameron Harris crack open that Bud Light almost immediately after walking, and wondered to herself if perhaps she'd glimpsed something then without really seeing it, that maybe what this investigator's questions appeared to be implying was something she'd known from the beginning. Every interruption by a customer felt like a reprieve. She was sweating. She was suddenly and terribly afraid. Euclide left the busy bee with his head more clouded than when he'd entered. A more cynical inquisitor, surveying all the miracle kitsch for sale, might have conjectured the possibility of the Lays being complicit in a miracle hoax. Their witnessing, after all, was netting them a profit. But Euclide had seen all this before, most vividly in Medjugorje in Bosnia, where the Virgin Mary is said to have appeared to 6 children in 1981. In the wake of any miracle come pilgrims, and behind them, inevitably, the souvenir mongers. The announcement of a miracle is also the announcement of an imminent crap bazaar. Not to mention, Janice's conspiracy net was already wide enough. Still, Euclide's interview with Leti Hat failed to neutralize the doubts Janice had seeded. And those doubts, the more Euclide considered them, began sprouting and branching. A high-profile hoax would do more than just threaten Reverend Fahey's sainthood cause. If and when another event was credited to Fahey's intercession, the congregation, singed by scandal, was likely to move slowly, if at all, thus denying Norton Skaggs his life's last remaining goal. Now a hoax like this could threaten the Catholic Church as well, exposing the Church to ridicule and vitriol during an already fragile moment in its history. His job was to serve the cause of Archbishop Nicholas Fahey. His blood allegiance, however, was to the Holy See. That he needed to interview Cameron Harris was a given, of course. Perhaps surprisingly, Euclide hadn't planned to speak with Cameron during this initial swing through Mississippi. The dismiss rule notwithstanding, at this stage he'd considered Father Ace's interview notes to be sufficient. Euclide's instincts, however, both prosecutorial and canonical, were telling him to continue to postpone that interview. He knew he'd rattled Hat with his questions, and he was regretting it. He didn't want to poison what could be, probably was, a run-of-the-mill miracle investigation, thereby bungling Reverend Fahey's chances for sainthood based upon a skeptical physician's high-strung suspicions. Norton Skaggs would have to be patient, would need to stifle that inner Ahab of his. If Euclide was going to seek the hand of the divine, he needed to dust for human fingerprints first. Years before, in Rome, Euclide worked with a police inspector who was fond of quoting William Butler Yeats. The light of lights looks always on the motive, not the deed. The shadow of shadows on the deed alone. Cameron's motive, the light of lights, struck Euclide as the obvious linchpin to Janice's theory. She'd admitted to him in her office that the motive she'd assigned Cameron was entirely her own invention, that she'd devised it, sans evidence, in order to service the theory's other moving parts. To connect the dots, she'd created a dot. Euclide wasn't sold on it. There were far easier ways to get out of combat duty, more immediately shameful, perhaps. But what was shame when stacked against 4 years of self-confinement in a wheelchair? And could he have instead just manufactured a limp? He didn't share Janice's suspicions with Father Ace, though the priest was eager for Euclide's assessment, but he did have Father Ace photocopy the notes from his interviews with Cameron for him. These he took to a restaurant, Mary Mahoney's old French house in Biloxi, where his young waitress, noting the Maserati out front and his leading man looks, asked if he was in town for the miracle show. After a slow black chuckle, he told her no, but her questions served to confirm, lucidly, the importance of this case. Cameron Harris's recovery wasn't just a mystery, it was a spectacle. Whatever Euclide did needed to be airtight. He was barely three sips into his Negroni, reviewing Father Ace's notes, before a line of Cameron seized him as if by the throat. A lot of things happened to me in Afghanistan. Getting paralyzed, that was just one of them. He peered up from the papers and from his rust-colored cocktail, staring into the middle distance. Was this line of Cameron's a kind of cracked door, behind which Janice's motive might be hiding? What else would Cameron equate with a paralyzing injury? Euclide sipped his drink without tasting it, ignoring a chunky pair of sunburnt men in fishing shirts who were ogling his Maserati through the window and angling for his attention as its owner. If Janice's hunch had any chance of being correct, he realized, the motive was to be found somewhere in Afghanistan, on some shell-casing-littered ridgeline. Afghanistan would have been the motive's birthplace, would have been where, before anything could be done to conceal it, it was visible. Only one member of Cameron's platoon was mentioned in the notes. Staff Sergeant DeMarcus Lockwood, who'd been injured by the same blast that had wounded Cameron, apparently more severely. Euclide was tapping his iPhone screen as the waitress, for reasons he pretended not to understand, delivered him a second Negroni, that with an unshy smile, she said was on her. Lockwood's unusual first name made him a cinch to locate. A phone call was all Euclide had in mind, until he noted the address. Lockwood lived outside the small town of Helen, Georgia, in the state's mountainous northeast corner, near the border with North Carolina. Checking the map on his phone, he saw that the town was barely a fractional detour on his way back to Knoxville, and scissoring his fingertips to zoom the map closer, that the area's back roads resembled a lovely bowl of spaghetti, the sort of squiggly mountain roads that Maserati engineers in the 1970s had designed his Spider to make love to. Euclide thanked the waitress for the gratis, though untouched Negroni, slightly savoring the look of disappointment on her face. He slid into his car and started it, listening closely and rapturously to its engine growl as another man might tune his ear to Bach. And then, with the twilight oyster-colored beach to his right and the perishing sun smearing the sky violet behind him, he pointed the car's trembling hood toward Georgia. Both hands gripping the leather steering wheel, Euclide Abasha was anticipating twists ahead. Just nothing like the twist he was headed for. Chapter 15. The December 31st call sheet for production of Miracle Man was forecasting a light and agreeable workday. Because the schedule had them shooting past midnight, in order to film Cameron and Tanya welcoming the new year in a Biloxi bar, the crew members, most of whom had flown back from the West Coast the night before, savored a rare opportunity to sleep in, with no one needing to report to Reconfort Avenue before noon. Actual filming wasn't slated to begin until 3 p.m., when Cameron and Tanya would be reenacting their Christmas supper, or rather, staging a Christmas supper, since on Christmas Day they grazed at a church lunch following Mass at Our Lady Queen of Angels before settling back home to watch Revenge of the Nerds 3 and Fast and Furious 6. The plan called for interviews after that. Meaning of Christmas, noted the call sheet. Hopes for the new year. Followed by a long dinner break doubling as a cast and crew holiday party. Then at 9 p.m. they'd be moving to a location shoot at a dive bar called Guidry's Lava Lounge that on the call sheet had been slyly renamed the Champagne Room. By 1 p.m., however, the morning's bright popcorn clouds were giving way to ominous gray streaks, a smudgescape rolling in overhead that could have been seen as a harbinger of things to come if such skies weren't so endemic to winter afternoons along the Gulf Coast. Huntley Bennis, the director of photography, or DP, known as Honeybun, was standing out on the driveway with Aiden Casey, the camera assistant. One of the camera batteries wasn't charging properly, and with cigarettes jouncing on their lips, the two men were passing the battery back and forth, listlessly stumped. Then with a glance over Honeybun's shoulder, Casey's mouth flopped open.
"Whoa," he said. "Check it out."
Coming down the center of Reckonford Avenue was Mrs. Dooley, slowly but steadfastly, clicking her walker ahead of her. Though neither man had ever seen Mrs. Dooley off her porch, they'd filmed interviews about Cameron's recovery with her there. This wasn't on its own what had snatched Casey's attention and was now fastening the men's gaze to her. Something about her shuffling carriage looked fraught to them, the explicit purpose of it, its wizened down-tempo urgency, the way her jutting chin seemed to be drawing the rest of her down the crackled asphalt.
"Yoda's on the march," Casey whispered.
The two men watched her for a while.
"What's she doing?"
"Grabbing the 305, Honeybun ordered, sensing the potential for story intrigue, but at the moment more beguiled with the scene's aesthetic. The strange and elegiac figure the old woman was cutting against that roiling, glooming Book of Revelation sky. Within a minute, he had the camera shouldered and was filming Mrs. Dooley's slow-motion approach. Arriving at the front of the Harris house, Mrs. Dooley didn't pause. She just crooked her walker to the left, making a sharp, smooth Pac-Man turn, and scaling the curb, she started up the front walkway.
"Howdy,"
Honeybun can be heard calling to her on the footage. Without acknowledging the greeting or turning her head or even her eyes, Mrs. Dooley asked,
"Cameron Harris inside?"
"Sure is," came Honeybun's answer. Then to Casey he hissed,
"Run and mic her." "She released? She's released. Get a mic on her."
Casey approached her warily, perhaps intuiting her reaction to him trying to pin a tiny microphone to her house dress. She swatted at him as though he were a gargantuan horsefly. When he tried again, bargaining with her as a nurse might bargain with a patient refusing a medical test, she rammed him with her walker to continue on her way. Casey threw a comically flummoxed shrug at Honeybun before Honeybun waved him out of the scene. Two-thirds of the way up the walkway, Mrs. Dooley came to a stop, and as if addressing the front door, asked again,
"Cameron inside?"
"Yes, he is," answered Honeybun.
"Y'all go fetch him for me."
Honeybun motioned for Casey to do this without entering the camera frame, sending him scampering into the house through the side door. Half a minute later, the front door opened, and out came Tanya, still in her oversized nightshirt, with Cameron trailing behind.
"Mrs. Dooley?"
said Tanya, in her voice a mixture of confusion and diffuse concern and the residue of interrupted sleep. The way Casey had roused her and Cameron from the couches had been abrupt and mildly alarming. An evacuation order. Mrs. Dooley said,
"I want to talk to Cameron."
"He's right here,"
Tanya said, as Cameron slipped past his sister to where Mrs. Dooley stood parked behind her walker. On his way, he flashed a peeved look at the camera, unsure why this unscheduled visit was being filmed, and then glanced up the street toward Mrs. Dooley's house on the corner, gauging the distance she'd traveled in her house slippers and what on earth that could mean. Then he looked down at her, noting a tremor on her lip and a redness spidering her eyes.
"Something wrong?"
he asked. She took a deep, pained breath.
"I want to know," she said. "Did you pray for my grandson?"
Cameron Harris had been acquainted with Eula Dooley his entire life, and he could tell from the seething tightness in her voice that she was upset. He knew what the musk of her anger smelled like, from her having thrashed his bottom 16 years earlier, and he was smelling it now. But her grandson? Him praying?
"Do what?"
he asked.
"I says, did you pray for my grandson, like I asked you?"
"Like you asked me?" His face was slack with bewilderment.
"Right after you risen," she told him, "I asked you to pray for him for me. To tell Jesus he needed watching over."
Cameron nodded, his memory apparently jogged.
"Then, yeah," he said. "Of course I woulda."
Mrs. Dooley loosened her grip on her walker and rocked back on her heels as though satisfied, but not soothed by this answer. Her gaze drifted down to Cameron's no longer spindly legs, and after a while she let out a thick grunt.
Just look at you now, she said, far from admiringly.
Her tone felt more suited to someone addressing a drunk crumpled at the bottom of a stairwell.
Yes, sir. Look at you now. Jesus worked a wonder on you, didn't he?
Yes, ma'am, he did. Cameron's face was registering even deeper confusion. He sure did.
Yeah,
she said, drawing it out, her red eyes narrowing as she assessed Cameron's legs once again.
Jesus worked a sure enough wonder.
By this time, Scott T. Griffin had arrived outside from the kitchen, where he'd been editing on his laptop wearing earphones and had therefore missed Casey's call to action. His mood was foul from not knowing what was happening, and because whatever was happening was being filmed without audio support. The production sound mixer, Austin Croft, wasn't scheduled until 2. In the footage, he can be heard whisper shouting at Casey why nobody was mic'd. By this time also, Tanya had joined her brother on the front walk. Cameron felt her hand on his back as she said to Mrs. Dooley about the grandson,
"That's Antoine you was talking about, right? He's still up in Chicago?"
Mrs. Dooley nodded with her chin, looking to the ground and then up again. Her bottom lip shook.
"Antoine got shot last night."
"Shot?"
Tanya's shoulders sank.
"How?"
"Coming out of a store, just like our store there."
She waggled a finger toward the busy bee.
"Police was looking for someone held up another store. Said he pulled a knife. Boy, I didn't have no knife."
At this point, Griffin slipped into the frame carrying 3 sets of lavalier microphones, the same kind of miniature clip-on mic that Casey earlier had tried clamping onto Mrs. Dooley's dress. Untangling cords, he said,
"Y'all just hold for a second while we get these on." "The police shot him?"
Tanya was asking Mrs. Dooley.
"Just hold up,"
Griffin barked.
"My daughter,"
Mrs. Dooley said, ignoring Griffin, who was threading a wire underneath the back of Cameron's t-shirt.
"She called me from the hospital this morning, thinking he was gonna make it. I says, yes, he'll make it. I says, we got some heavy prayers on our side. Jesus himself would be in that room with Twain. With my own eyes, I have gazed upon his wonders. I did. That's what I told her."
"I really need a pause here, folks,"
said Griffin, as he wedged himself between the Harrises and Mrs. Dooley and began stringing a mic toward her. Cameron's hand shot out to grab Griffin's forearm.
"Leave her be,"
Cameron said. Firmly and articulately, he lowered Griffin's arm, then released it. A stunned look passed across Griffin's face that was quickly replaced by a pinkish glower. On the footage, Tanya can be seen startling, then shrinking back, as though catching a darkly familiar frequency in her brother's voice. Cameron said,
"This here ain't got nothing to do with what happened to me." "That's actually my call,"
Griffin snapped back, making another attempt to pin the mic to Mrs. Dooley. She lifted her hand to swat him, as she'd swatted Casey, just as Cameron grasped Griffin's wrist, and this time held it.
"This ain't your story,"
Cameron growled, screwing his eyes into Griffin's, squeezing his wrist, that big neck vein of Cameron's throbbing.
"Remember?"
Tanya, her mouth forming a circle of shock, placed a hand on Cameron's shoulder. This was to placate him, but must have also seemed to Griffin a signal of her support, leaving Griffin no one to whom he could appeal. Wriggling his wrist, the pink flush of his face gone crimson hot, Griffin opened his mouth to respond, but apparently thought better of it. Once Cameron let go of his wrist, Griffin wound up his arm as though to whip the mic and its cords to the ground, but apparently thought better of that too. He kept his eyes trained on the lawn as he went stomping out of the camera frame, the mic cables trailing him like empty leashes.
"Can we just put a fucking boom on them?"
he ordered Casey. None of the 3 acknowledged what had just happened with Griffin, Tanya resuming the moment Griffin's back was turned their way.
"Is Antoine okay?"
she asked, fearing the answer. Mrs. Dooley shook her head. Cameron said,
"He didn't make it."
Mrs. Dooley's head was still shaking. Tanya slid a hand over her mouth, and Cameron turned his head away from the camera and toward Division Street, where a car was pulling into the Busy Bee. Maybe for a cold six-pack, maybe for some life-saving grace. He was just starting to understand Mrs. Dooley's anger, that cold-ass way she'd regarded his legs, and it both stung and confounded him. Him walking had nothing to do with Anne Twain dying. Nothing. And him praying. Prayers didn't stop bullets, he thought. They weren't a Kevlar vest. They